All right. Paper 118 again. Section 4, which is old single column, page 1298. Let's see, who'd like to be a reader tonight? Yeah. Now this one, this section, you need to put your thinking caps back on.
Dog ate mine.
This is a pretty significant section, actually, in that whole big picture that we attempted to wrap our minds around when we went through that paper on total deity. You'll see as we get into this, this is really speaking in the full context of that picture. That's why without that context, this section is sort of vague and indeterminate exactly what they're trying to get at. We won't, belabor the point, but I wanted to allude to some of the things that we talked about in Total Deity enough that that's why I handed out just a copy of that page 2 with the 7 functional levels of Total Deity on it again, so that you have all of the names and the labels right there in front of you if you haven't memorized them yet. But, the idea that we always speak in is we take those 7 levels, putting them in a linear, vertical stack like that, and what do? We wrap them around the infinite eternal ellipse. And they become domains around that ellipse. Those 7 levels become 7 domains around the ellipse, where the way to really visualize it is to have that level 1 domain on the long side at the top of the ellipse, the root of everything, the original up there, and then the other long side across down on the bottom here is where you and I are in the evolutional level, and everything else spreads out in between there. We're not going to, do endless discussions in that, but I wanted to, make sure that you could see the details that are, in that list there to really understand what, especially the root paragraph in this section is trying to convey. Okay, so primary and secondary causation, should be pretty obvious what they're getting at, but let's see specifically what they mean by secondary.
Many of the theologic difficulties and the metaphysical dilemmas of mortal man are due to man's mislocation of deity personality and consequent assignment of infinite and absolute attributes to subordinate divinity and to evolutionary deity. You must not forget that while there is indeed a true first cause, there are also a host of coordinate and subordinate causes, both associate and secondary causes.
Okay. Now, before we talk about any of the details, just in general there, everyone I'm sure recognizes that they're alluding to the fact that you don't just have a simple little single point deity or God concept in the actuality of infinity. There's a lot of complexity. So, when you guys think about it, what's the first thing that pops into your head is an example of, when they talk about, not everything being infinite and absolute, what's an example of deity or God where that's not the case?
Supreme and the ultimate.
Yeah, big examples. Some smaller examples come to mind? Creator Son. Yeah, Creator Son is a very definitive, example of, it's as far removed as you can get, basically. Yeah, right. So, it obviously, you know, they're bringing into play, you know, for instance, all the fact that the sevenfold and all that complexity, that's anything but singular, you know, and you try to contemplate the sevenfold. You know, and that might have even, you know, specifically come to mind when you saw a divinity there instead of deity. And like, you know, when we start to try to talk in detail about the sevenfold, we have the creators and the controllers, and you know, and the controllers, it's you know, a frandalank isn't anything that you're going to call deity, you know, but it's definitely divinity. But the real main point that they're trying to get at in this session is not first and foremost the sevenfold. That's certainly in play. But notice that word mislocation. We've been talking about this quite a bit lately. There's one overarching issue of mislocation that has been muddling up theology and metaphysics forever. And we brought that up a number of times here. You have a distinct difference between God as transcendence and God as immanence. If you co-locate transcendence and immanence, then instantly God is illogical. You know, he's both without and within. And you say, well, that's not really logical. You know, he could somehow be on both sides of a boundary. Well, no, stop and think about it a second. If he's on both sides, then, and he is, and there's nothing greater than him, then the boundary, he supersedes the boundary. The boundary disappears if he's on both sides. That's called the I am. That's the starting point of the singular concept of the I am. If God is both on the outside and the inside, if he's both transcendence and immanence, you can't have one fact co-located on an outside and inside. That means there is no outside and inside. There's only one side, his side.
He did find a way to get around.
To free himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. And we know he did that. And that's more than anything else. That's what they're talking about in that opening allusion there to mislocation. And one of the fascinating things, it ties right in with what we've been saying all along here. Notice it's not like they spoon feed that to you. You know, there's no big arrows saying, now when I say this, think of, okay? But you'll see as you go forward, that's the primary thing they're wanting you to think about. That fact that you get your whole notion of God and your relationship to God and the nature of the universe all muddled up right from the get-go, if you don't have some way in your understanding of reality to have a distinction and a way to understand that distinction between transcendence and immanence. Immanent where, transcendent where, how, you know, in what way are they differentiated, etc. Some way to be able to think in that at least that twofold space. Now, we all know that really to think about everything, you got to bring the sevenfold and all kinds of complexity. But now, we've got to mention it in passing here before we go on, because we've sort of have completed the four different versions now with the words deity and divinity. Those two words are the first things that are defined up in the foreword. We've had deity with a capital D, and we've had deity with a lowercase d, and we've had divinity with a lowercase d, and now we have divinity with an uppercase D. Okay, what are they trying to get at? Well, they're just trying to complete the whole picture. They're using the capital letters, like we said before, as a way of getting you to be initially in the right orientation with the sentence before you start thinking about it. Am I supposed to be thinking bottom up or top down? Okay. Remember when we were talking about deity before, that if we had a capital D, we were very much talking about the unity viewpoint. Deity, capital D, coming down. Okay. And we used the lowercase d deity, when when we were talking about the Almighty, remember, and they were trying to remind us that in order to start thinking about the Almighty, you're thinking about potentials being drawn up into actuals. Okay, so they used and you talk about those potentials, the two potentials that are related to deities being the deity absolutes, lowercase d. So that you can think of it, you have these potentials for capital D deity, lowercase d deity, see, being drawn up into actuals. But you have absolute actuals that are also being expressed downward, and so you just use a capital D directly for those. So just to get you in that mode. Well, you have the same thing here. You and I, as ascending sons of God, we work our way up, and finally we can use the word divinity, attached to our nature. As a finaliter, we're divine, finitely divine. Lowercase d. Very important to remember that, you didn't come down from above. Okay. But here they're saying, you have deity, and there's the divinity of deity. So that deity, capital D, coming down, if you want to really talk about the divinity of it, they're saying, one way to just kind of immediately put you in that mode, a very top-down mode, capitalize the D. Like, for instance, when we talk about the sevenfold, we start with the deity up at the top, the Father, and we start coming down, and it's like, well, on the creator side, we can seem to be able to keep the capital D just fine, but boy, on the controller side, right away, we hit the Isle of Paradise, right off the bat, and the deity, where deity doesn't even seem to make sense, and, So you're thinking more altogether. You have, if you want to talk about the whole thing collectively with a common word, it would be capital D divinity. Because the actions of the Isle of Paradise are divine, because the first source and center is behind those actions. But it's obviously not deity. Okay, so that's what they're getting at there. Now, just before we read the next paragraph, notice the sentence that leads into the next paragraph. No fuzziness. You must not forget that. Okay. We've pointed this out. I've been saying must and a lot in the last several weeks because they are. It's just constant. They keep putting these emphatic statements down in front of us. You must, and you're going, I must, that's like, okay, coordinate, a subordinate, associate, why is that a must? Okay. I mean, maybe if I'm trying to be a scholar and I can't call bananas apples. I understand that. Okay. But, it's not that. It's not scholarly foolishness that they're, saying is a must. For some reason, they're saying must. What do you see when you start reading the next paragraph?
The vital distinction between first causes and second causes is that first causes produce original effects which are free from inheritance of any factor derived from any antecedent causation. Secondary causes yield effects which invariably exhibit inheritance from other and preceding causation.
Okay, everything except, if you just don't notice the first, three words, you're going, okay, this is not helping me. It's all this stuff about preceding and blah, blah. Okay, this distinction is vital. Okay? They're hearkening back to, that key sentence again. Okay? Like I said, The main thing is transcendence, immanence. And this distinction is vital. It's not just important from a scholarly point of view. It's vital. Because the whole nature of what you are as a living phenomenon and what God is as a living God is in this distinction. You cannot understand yourself or God if you don't make this distinction. You must make this distinction. You can't let it blur together. It's because it harkens back to the root of everything. You know, that distinction gives rise to everything. Yeah? So you can't understand anything without that distinction. You can contemplate the infinite, but, you know, okay, there's no me in the infinite. So why do I want to contemplate the infinite? So that's, you know, since we've been, you know, going around and around on that, we know what they're getting at here. Well, as soon as we hear vital distinction, we know we're talking about the mother. You know, that somehow is, you know, key in here. So think about an example here. Secondary causes yield effects which invariably exhibit inheritance from other and preceding causation. Let's take a little simple example so that you can just understand all that fancy verbiage. We've been going, we've been coming back to this time and time again. We know that we have back there, you know, rooted in the original, we have this fact that we call the infinite upholder, for instance. Now, is there anything that stems from that? Does that just remain as a primary point of causation? Or is there something that, is there a downstepped expression of that? Yeah, like the finite upholder.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's why we named it that, because it exhibits inheritance from other and preceding causation. That which we call the finite upholder is called that because it harkens back to the root, the infinite upholder. And to remind you of that, you give them the same name, just like you would, you know, give them all of days names, or eternals of days, ancients of days, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah? They're trying to give you an immediate clue in the very designation, you know, of a commonality. And in this case of the infinite upholder and the finite upholder, very much directly what we're talking about. There's primary causation, and then down here in the finite, down below the infinite, there's secondary causation.
So you've heard that expression, as above, so below.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, but that's kind of the top down, I guess. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about here is really the opposite of that, as below, so above. Because, you know, you've got the infinite upholder, finite upholder, local universe upholder.
Well, I mean,
it's connected.
Right, yeah, the fact that it's connected, and you can think about it in both directions. I mean, for instance, when you're in this purely initially subjective bottom-up mode, and you start thinking about the world around you, you say, well, you know, I think I have mind. You have a choice at that point. You can decide that mind just manifests in you magically, or you can say, you know, I don't think that sounds right. I think it has to have a source. There has to be a cause of mind. So there has to be at least one level of mind above my mind that can be a source. You know, you can take anything in the world around you, anything in your experiences, and you can, you know, chart a course upward in your mind along that track and see if you can find its roots. Can you take it up? And of course, with the revelation, you know, we do it all the time. We start at the finite, we go up into the absolute, and up to the infinite. We're constantly taking things and finding how they're threaded up into the first source and center, or into the original. And do you have something that you want to bring into? Okay, so that's, okay, and see there's a big gap here, paragraph gap. So that the first thing I wanted to do is just make those little vague statements, but they're not so vague, since we know what we're looking for now. It's obvious what how they're wanting to set you up. They're setting you up to think about God as immanence, God the Mother. So now look at this next paragraph. Okay, one more thing.
This revelation is giving us all of this new information.
Mm-hmm.
And fourth epical revelation, where Jesus talked about the Father. Right. And before that, I mean, it was just, let's see if we can get past justice, you know, Moses.
Yeah.
But it's almost like there are these incubation periods. This last one took 2,000 years,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, they wouldn't have given his book to us prematurely or later than we needed it either.
Yeah.
So it came in at on time.
Yeah.
Now, we might have been able to go faster if we hadn't done X, Y, and Z mm-hmm. over the last 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. But here we are.
Right.
So it's a question of, when you say, well, you can't figure out anything if you don't know this.
Right.
Well, that's true for today.
Right.
But it wasn't necessarily true for, you know, Thomas Aquinas or
right. I mean, Peter Paul. I mean, obviously I was, you know, I wasn't being highly precise with my wording there.
Well, no,
I mean, you can obviously figure out you're a child of God.
Yeah.
And that there's a God. Right. Okay. But what I meant about figure out is I meant, you know, to be able to have a literal, logical understanding of things, you know, to go beyond mere recognition. To do that, you know, I can recognize there's a God, and you know, and I might even recognize that I'm a child or even a son of that God. You know, especially if I really listen to what Jesus told me 2,000 years ago. But do I understand exactly how that all works?
Well, you know, it seems to me that there's a part of that incubation period is the faith grasp.
Right, that's the first step.
And yeah, and when you say, well, you know, this mystery I can't figure out,
mm-hmm.
but I know, you know, it's not logical. In other words, we've got the logic now. Mm-hmm. There's still plenty of mystery, but before you had to say. You had to say, well, I don't understand this, but I believe God figured it out, and he'll right. tell me about it when I die, or right. some such thing.
Right. And one of the main things that's in play between the fourth and the fifth epical revelations, Jesus came, gave us the fourth epical revelation because he needed to get us to take that first step. We all had to be making a faith grasp.
Yeah.
Because nothing's going to happen if you don't, you know, give yourself that little measure of father likeness, initiator likeness, and initiate the process. Grasp it, even in complete ignorance, just grasp it. And you know, we've incubated now with that faith grasp to the point where we're ready to begin to take the next step. Now, in an ascension career sense, remember how they tell you that, you know, as you move up, each step up you take, what before was achieved merely by faith, some little measure of that faith gets replaced by literal knowing. You know, you got to go to eternity, so you always need faith, okay? But the whole point is you take a step up and you replace a small measure of faith by a direct knowing. You know, I don't just recognize this, you know, faith, personal recognition. I don't just have a personal recognition of the next notch up. I am the next notch up. You know, I know it. I don't know about it. I know it, okay? I've achieved that internally.
It's kind of more evident. I mean, obviously when you die... You know, you wake up on the mansion world, even if you were the strictest scientist,
right.
that nothing but matter exists, here you are with direct evidence and proof to the contrary.
But the thing that that's not so much what we're focusing on right now. That's the ascension career. I mean, we're just here right now.
Okay.
None of us have even made it to the first mansion world yet. so what's the point of this now? There is something that you should be doing, starting with faith. You shouldn't be satisfied, even now, with mere faith. You should be challenging yourself to grow that faith into a trust and an assurance. Okay. Because advancing civilization needs individuals who have a greater solidity internally than spiritual faith can offer. Because spirit is not a substance that you possess right now. But soul is. See, and it's a spiritual faith, but it's a soul trust. Can you take that faith and make it substance?
Trust.
And the assurance that results from that. Okay? Because you need that trust and assurance out on the high seas. We've steamed out of the shelter bays. We're about to move out on the high seas. Okay? If all you have is faith, guess what is companion with that faith, that faint flicker of faith? It's constantly fighting against doubt and fear. Okay? You need to begin to take control of doubt and fear. And mere faith can't do that. Or at the very least, it has to constantly redo it. Faith, fear, faith, fear, faith, fear. We need to get out of that, you know, that mode where we're dancing back and forth. No, just trust and fear not forevermore. See? That's what Jesus said you should do next. Trust.
Is it kind of like trust is putting, is more of a father thing? Not trust, no, faith. Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Faith, and it's like it's a constant initiating.
Right.
Whereas trust is more from the matter side. And what the mother does, personal purpose of puts that into a pattern. And it takes that, the initiation of the faith, mm-hmm. and puts it into the pattern of a trust. So it has a self-regulating and self, it keeps on going into the future.
Remember, you know, see, you know, if you...
Without you having to and keep initiating.
Right, right, exactly. Right, see, it's substance. So it just is. When you fall back, you fall back on it. A higher substance than the substance that is fear. Okay, and you know, literally, you know, see, it's a mother-like action to wrap your mind around that faith. There's an initiation in that faith grasp, a father-like act. Wrap your mind around it. If you wrap your mind around that faith, that what that mind looks like that's wrapped around that faith, it has a cosmic character. Well, guess what the adjuster can do with mind that has a cosmic character? It can make it into a substance. Okay, and now... And you know, we know that there's a feedback. It's much easier to put your mind in that cosmic form because it has a catalyst and a touchstone. That the soul reinforces the mind, that liquid that wants to always flow off into fear again. You know, you put it together in cosmic harmony and it's not afraid, but then it flows away. But wouldn't it be great if there was something that constantly, you know, a solid that couldn't melt away, that constantly reinforced that form. So it took less exertion on your part to keep it together, and you could think about building the next thing wrapped around it. That, you know, you want to continue, get this wrapping your mind around a character, okay? And the assurance that comes from that soul trust. Okay, so that's, I mean, the primary reason why this distinction is vital, is getting into this recognition of the difference between your relationship to God the Father and your relationship to God the Mother, and how you have to get both of these thoughts going in your head. You can't just think faith followed by magic. You know, advancing civilization can't be predicated on that. Early civilization can, because what holds it together? The cattle prods. You know, slavery, war, social classes, profit motive. You know, do you want to be cattle prodded for all eternity? No, we all want to get out of those modes. That means you got to make that integrity that's behind those cattle prods, that tough love, you got to make that integrity inside. It's got to become substance inside. All right. So, this next paragraph, we'll read it through, and then I'll slowly go. This is the meat. You know, and you'll just know before you start to read it, I'm in the mode of the total deity discussion. That's what this paragraph is about.
The purely static potentials inherent in the unqualified absolute are reactive to those causations of the deity absolute which are produced by the actions of the Paradise Trinity. In the presence of the universal absolute, these causative impregnated static potentials forthwith become active and responsive to the influence of certain transcendental agencies whose actions result in the transmutation of these activated potentials to the status of true universe possibilities for development, actualized capacities for growth. It is upon such matured potentials that the creators and controllers of the grand universe enact the never-ending drama of cosmic evolution.
Okay, whole bunch of stuff there. Not immediately obvious what they're saying. So before you think about anything, there's one word in that thick paragraph that should have jumped out. Okay. Ask yourself just a very simple question that anyone can answer. You don't need to know total deity. Anyone can answer this simple question. Who is it that is impregnated? Fathers or mothers? Okay. This paragraph is obviously not about fathers. Okay, it's about mothers. It has the word impregnated in it. Okay. Let something that simple change your whole approach to trying to understand the paragraph. It's like, wait a minute, fathers aren't impregnated. Why on earth are they saying impregnated? This paragraph must be about God the Mother, not God the Father. Okay, now, they always, almost always start us off in the individuality viewpoint. Remember when we went through total deity, we came to recognize that these names, unqualified absolute, deity absolute, and universal absolute, were the individuality viewpoint names. They also had unity viewpoint designations that they introduce only one place in the book, back there in Deity and Reality, that heavy-duty paper that, the initial faint flicker of faith can't find and figure out what to do with. Okay? All right, so let's just look at it in the individuality viewpoint to start with. Okay, just remember in that individuality viewpoint, unqualified absolute, reservoir for matter, deity absolute, reservoir for spirit, universal absolute, reservoir for mind. Matter, spirit, mind. Okay, so just with that simplistic viewpoint, the first thing I would be getting out of it is, okay, so whatever we're talking about here, it's going to have a relationship with matter and a relationship with spirit. I haven't quite totally figured out exactly how that all works, but it's talking about both of them. So it has a relationship with matter and a relationship with spirit. And then it says that there's a presence of mind. In the presence of the universal absolute. Oh, wait a minute. We have been talking about things like that. Yeah, where we have a mind womb, a mind presence. That's the mother we've been talking about. Okay, and we know that that you definitely have, you don't just talk about mind. When you talk about like the creative mother spirit, you talk about her, dealing with energy issues and definitely with spirit issues like the Holy Spirit. So there's a relationship with matter and spirit, and there's this very much this womb of mind. Okay, so that's the basic that you get from the individuality viewpoint there. Now flip it around, okay. And here's where you might want to remind yourself, looking at the designations on that in those levels of function of total deity, or going around the infinite eternal ellipse. The unqualified absolute, from the unity viewpoint, is a facet of deity. That facet of deity is called the infinite capacity. And the deity absolute, from the unity viewpoint, the designation, again, it's a facet of deity. You know, think of them as reservoirs now. They're facets of deity from the unity viewpoint. That's the infinite potential. So the infinite capacity and the infinite potential. Okay, so let's just start with that. It's like, okay, so they're saying that what I'm talking about here is going to have some measure of capacity to it. Because it says it's related to the infinite capacity. And we know we're not talking about the infinite here. We're talking about some downstepped expression, some measure of that nature. So it has some capacity. And the infinite potential, if you notice on there, that's called self-purposive deity. Okay? So in this capacity, it's going to become impregnated, okay, with a purposiveness. There's going to be a capacity of purposiveness to this thing I'm thinking about here. All right, now that should remind you of something. You know, as we were going through talking about the Supreme and trying to understand the Supreme in those two facets that are actually down here in the finite, the Almighty on the one hand and the Mother on the other hand, or the power pattern, the Almighty on the one hand, and the personal purposive, the Mother on the other hand. Ah, yeah, it definitely does sound like it's talking about Mother. A capacity impregnated with a purposiveness, that personal purposive part of this domain that we're talking about, this capacity.
What? How are we using words like purposive or creative rather than creator?
Because we are talking about deity, not God. God is personalized deity. The first thing we have to understand is what is it that's going to get personalized? What kind of deity, what flavor of deity is going to get personalized? When we talk about the Mother type of deity, what is that type of deity like? What's its nature? And then it's going to be personalized. That nature is going to get personalized as God the Mother. But what's its nature? You must not forget, we must understand the difference in the flavor of the Father-type deity from the Mother-type deity.
Yeah. I've always associated purpose and personality, almost as synonyms. But I'm picking up, there's purposive implies an inherent purpose. It's pre-personality.
Yeah. Yeah, look. That was one of the first things that should have gotten you really grinding in your head as you tried to understand those levels of total deity function. When you noticed that there's three things on there that before that you always kind of blurred together. They have something on there labeled self-willed deity, and then they have something labeled self-purposive deity, and then they have something labeled self-personalized deity. And they're three separate things. That's your first hint that, whoa, the total deity is a lot more complicated than I initially thought. It's actually very subtle. You know, and you have to start beginning to tease those thoughts apart. The infinite one is self-willed deity, you know, and that's pretty straightforward. We always think of that as a reservoir of all will. But the deity absolute, or the infinite potential, that's self-purposive deity. Okay. Don't want to belabor that. Just let that be an initial point of reflection. See if you can work on it in your head. Okay, so you've got a capacity impregnated with purposiveness. And then it says that that happened, it was produced by the actions of the Paradise Trinity. Okay, remember when this is another thing we finally understood how to think about it, and we went through total deity. We talk about the actions of the Paradise Trinity. That's like the Trinity of Supremacy, the Trinity of Ultimacy. When the Trinity functions on the supreme level, that's called the Trinity of Supremacy. The supreme level is level number 6 on that, in that chart there. That's the supreme level. When the Trinity functions on that level, that functioning of the Trinity on that level is called the Trinity of Supremacy. Okay? Well, if that Trinity is functioning on that level as the Trinity of Supremacy and doing this thing here relative to the infinite capacity and the infinite potential, getting this capacity impregnated with purposiveness, it's doing that in the presence of what on that sixth level? I mean, obviously we're trying to make the supreme, but what's the other thing that's on that level? There's two things. Just tell me, someone. No. What's the name? There's the supreme, and what's the other name on level 6? Just look on the level. Just read it. Level number 6, what's on that? The infinite upholder. If the Trinity of Supremacy is functioning on the supreme level, no matter what it's doing, it can't help but be in the presence of the infinite upholder. Because that's the infinite upholder permeates the sixth level. Okay? The infinite upholder, that's the unity viewpoint name for what, what do you call it in the individuality viewpoint? The universal absolute. In the presence of the universal absolute, or from the unity viewpoint, this Trinity is functioning in the presence of the infinite upholder. Okay?
Let me clarify something.
Yep.
Earlier you said that of these three absolutes, the universal absolute is the mind, right?
Right, when we're kind of living the individuality viewpoint, yeah. Okay.
And in the three supremes, isn't the Almighty supreme the mind?
No.
No.
No. No, I mean, you have the supreme mind, if you want to just talk about mind.
Not the Almighty.
Okay. Right now, see, we aren't literally talking about the supreme at all. We're talking about the functioning of the Paradise Trinity, and we're talking about the Paradise Trinity functioning on the supreme level. Okay. And if we know these are the levels of total deity function, so I mean, if we, you know, the Trinity is not directly on there. You're saying in that context of those levels, you know, if I have the Trinity functioning on level 6 there, it's functioning in the presence of another facet of deity. It's functioning in the presence of the infinite upholder. Well, if you take the infinite upholder and the functioning of the Trinity, of the Paradise Trinity as the Trinity of Supremacy, doing what we're just talking about it doing here with capacity and purpose, you have a relationship between two things. The relationship between the infinite upholder and what the Paradise, what the Trinity of Supremacy is doing, that relationship is the finite upholder. Like we said when we went through total deity. Okay? We just said it back then. Okay? The whole point is here. What were you looking for?
I'm terribly sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
You want us to leave the door?
Yeah, leave the door unlocked. Yeah.
We'll be happy.
Okay.
We
were talking about total deity, and we went through that total deity paper, we just said that the relationship between the Trinity of Supremacy and the infinite upholder is the finite upholder. We didn't talk about all the details. Okay, here they're talking about all the details, exactly what is the Trinity of Supremacy doing that is in relationship to the infinite upholder and giving rise as a superadditive consequence to this downstepped expression, the finite upholder. Because see, it's not the paradise trinity functioning in absoluteness or ultimacy. It's the paradise trinity functioning in supremacy. So it's a downstepped expression of the trinity. You bring that in relationship to the infinite upholder, and it's going to create a downstepped expression of the infinite upholder. It's a downstepping action in relationship to something that can get downstepped. Guess what happens? You get a downstepped expression of that which can be downstepped. You get the finite upholder. Okay. See, if you know total deity, the total deity picture, you can take these opening sentences and you can say them again in the unity viewpoint. I mean, really, all you need is what's in deity and reality. But we kind of carefully put it all together so it's a lot easier to talk about. And there we have it. You have how that facet of deity that's called the finite upholder, how it comes into existence. Okay? Now, it's not on the list there. It's in the, in the paper, later. If you read the whole paper. In the total deity paper. Yeah, it's like on the fifth page or whatever when we actually get to the point of talking about the supreme level. Okay, so now what else is in that paragraph? So the first part we now recognize is something that we actually have already talked about before. We just got all the details laid out there. So now it says that... Maybe one that they become forthwith active and responsive to the influence. Okay, and here's another point to kind of bring in before you read any further. Bring the unity and the individuality viewpoints together. A way to really understand the universal absolute and the mind that we talk about being related to the universal absolute. The universal absolute there is what's coming out of that reservoir, out of that potential, is an activation. It activates what you're talking about with experiential possibilities. And think about how that makes sense from what you know. Mind comes out of that reservoir. Where's your consciousness? It's in your mind. It's not in your matter. It's not in your spirit. It's in your mind. So where do you have experiences? In matter? In spirit? No, in mind. See, the mind is what gives you experiential possibility. Just kind of take that to a higher level. And just in general, see, that universal absolute is endowing what you're talking about with experiential possibilities. Why you could end up with experiential deity out of this process we're talking about here. Yeah, that's exactly. We just created a facet of deity, and we recognize that is as experiential deity that we're talking about here. It's been endowed, it's been activated with experiential possibility because of its relationship to the universal absolute. Now, there's one other little detail that we'll get into a little bit more as we get down, but they touch upon it here, this transcendental agencies. Who are the transcendental agencies that they're talking about here that are somehow involved in this whole process? It's not just the Paradise Trinity. There's something else involved in this. It's a very complicated process. So keep that in mind as we go down. But you notice, the status of true universe possibilities, see, for development, growth, capacity for growth, you're going to create this God the Mother domain, in which things can grow, because it's impregnated with that possibility. It's been ripened like that. And then just look at that last sentence. You know that creators and controllers, they're talking about the sevenfold. But look at how the sentence starts out. That what those creators and controllers are going to do, what all the individualities in God the Sevenfold are going to do is going to be upon something. It is upon such matured potentials. The upholder, like we've said so many times, the finite upholder, it's upon her that all of this stuff happens, like you and I growing and the Supreme Creator's acting and, you know, and the Supreme Controller's trying to, you know, get control of all the automatons. All that stuff is upon her. It's like they said, it is upon her that all that is going to transpire. All right, let's get into the
causation. Disregarding existentials is threefold in its basic constitution. As it operates in this universe age and concerning the finite level of the seven super universes, it may be conceived as follows.
Okay, before we read that, just one little thing there. I mean, there you definitely see that they don't want you to get into the absolute upholder and the absolute upholder and stuff. You know, they want you to just focus on the finite here to start with. But that first little part, again, you know, if you're trying to understand what they're telling you here, and all you have is a God the Father notion, and you've let the revelators expand that into the seven absolutes of infinity, and you're trying to understand everything they say with that, well, you know, the first thing they say is, well, disregard all of that existential stuff. It's like, well, now I have nothing. Okay? That's the only thing I thought that's all you've told me. The seven existentials, the seven absolutes of infinity.
Time to move on to the next paper.
Right. See, just you know, if you just, again, you know, it says impregnated. And I mean, if you just look at what this simple little thing they say right up front, it's putting a challenge. It's like, well, okay, what exactly, you know, do they want me to think about here? So think about, you know, what those, that causation, disregarding existentials. Well, who is behind the causation that is regarding existentials? Let's do that first. Let's do that part first. Who is behind the causation that is regarding existentials? Who do we call that person?
Infinite One?
No. God the Father. You know, behind, you know, the Son or the Spirit or the I, all, I mean, who is the causation that is regarding existentials? That's God the Father. So then you've got the parallel question. Who is the causation? You know, who is behind the causation, I should say, disregarding existentials? In other words, regarding experientials. That's not a who?
God the Mother.
God the Mother. Ah. Right? Trinity is non-personal. It's not a who. It's an it. That's why I purposely said who. Okay.
Well, how does Mother direct?
Well, we'll get that. We'll get that. We'll get that.
I know you've explained it numerous times, but right. I still stumble on it.
And I don't want to re-explain it right now because they give me a place to do that. I guess we probably won't get to it tonight, but next time. There's a really good place to kind of reinforce what we've said a number of times. It's up in that omnipotence and omnificence section. But right here, all they want us to do is just notice that they're challenging us to recognize, I've got to have a name. You know, you said it. If I'm going to use the word causation, you know, there needs to be a who. There needs to be a person behind it. I mean, whenever I think of causation, I'm thinking of a creator. I'm thinking of a who. And see, so that just the way they word that, you know who the causation, you know, who's behind the causation regarding existentials. So then the question is, who is behind the causation regarding experientials? It's like, well, one of the experientials is the supreme. One of the experientials is the ultimate. One of the experientials is the absolute. That can't be the who that's behind those experientials. I've got to have someone overarching those experientials that can be the who behind the causation of those experientials. I need another name.
Not just who's your dad.
Yeah, God the Mother.
One of the ways that I perceive this paper is that this is describing the simple question, what kind of stuff does God do? What does he do? We haven't even gotten to reality with this. This is a discussion of the different facets of God that take out of an ocean of absolute everything that's potential, everything that could be conceived of in the mind of God in this enormous ocean that we refer to as absolute. And then pull out a bucket. I call it a potential, and they endow it with a purpose, which is huge, but it's not reality. And what this is talking about can kind of, you know, one of the most poetic lines is the last sentence. It is upon such matured potentials that the creatures and the controllers of the grand universe enact the never-ending drama of cosmic evolution. So they're pulling this little bucket from the absolute ocean, and they're talking about how they mature it and move it into a potential, a purpose, and eventually folks like us turn it into a reality through our experiential capacity. And what is really intriguing is where it gets down into this section here. It says, causation disregarding existentials. Well, that's the fixins that God the Father does with this absolute prior to pulling it out or immediately after pulling it out. We haven't even reached a reality yet, but this is what the kind of thing he does is in his kitchen, okay? But then they talk about concerning the finite levels of the seven universes as it operates in this universe age, and concerning the finite levels of the seven super universes, it may be conceived as follows. This is the first step of the cookbook. Okay, this is where it is within the context of this universe age, but don't forget the rest of the ocean that's still out there that is subject to subsequent universe ages. That, in whole, if you look at it again, it is upon such matured potentials that the creatures and the controllers of the grand universe enact the never-ending drama of cosmic evolution. Mm-hmm. So, if I don't understand exactly what the cooking process is, all of the elements and the ingredients, I understand that there are multiple facets of God that are involved in the development and maturation of what we experience every day. It's not magic. It's, well, I guess from our perspective it is, but what they're telling us is this is the root of God's kitchen activities and what he does. Now, why he does it, don't have a clue. That's his purpose. But this gives us a really intriguing insight into the overall purpose of what God wants to do.
Right, and you know he wants to create a universe that's inhabited by creatures, and fundamentally to do that, he needs to initiate that universe from outside of it. And he needs to have something to uphold it when he initiates it. So he needs to have, there needs to be a God that remains in, a God of immanence. You know, that whole bit about purposiveness. So, you know, thinking about that deity absolute reservoir, what they're trying to point out is, and you think about way back at the very beginning of things, when you're trying to just get this set up, long before there's any creatures to engage, you know, long before the creators and controllers are going to go out there and enact a never-ending drama, you know, in the universes with creatures, you got to set the stage. And there's fundamentally two sides to that setting the stage. There are two large measures of purposiveness that get actualized, that potential. One large measure of that purposiveness goes into the initiating phenomenon, the initiating side of it. The other measure of purposiveness goes into the upholding side. You know, that's basically what you're doing is, right, you're dropping back and saying, if I have it all together, pooled together, the first thing I've got to do before I start thinking about supreme, ultimate, absolute, sun, you know, spirit, aisle, and sevenfold, and all that stuff, the first thing I've got to do is I have to have an inside and an outside. First thing, he freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. That's the first step. Okay? So I have to have a God without and a God within. I have to have a measure of purposeness without and a measure of purposiveness within. That purposiveness gets directed into two giant overarching parallel lines. And it's personalized. Yeah? This personality has this purpose, and this personality has this purpose. God the Mother has this purpose. God the Father has this purpose. All right. So, number one there, just read it and you'll see that this looks familiar.
Activation of static potentials. The establishment of destiny in the universal absolute by the actions of the deity absolute, operating in and upon the unqualified absolute, and in consequence of the volitional mandates of the Paradise Trinity.
Oh, well, that's that big paragraph, just two notches up that we just waded through. Okay, they're just repeating that's, you know, that's that basic picture that we just carefully went through in the third paragraph of the section here. Just restating it, kind of putting it all together in one little pithy statement, so that it fits into the sequence of 1, 2, 3. But there's one little twist in there that ties back to our total deity discussion again that I want you to notice. Why does it say operating in and upon the unqualified absolute? Why are there two prepositions there? Bless you. It says in and upon the unqualified absolute, or in and upon let's say it from the unity viewpoint, in and upon the infinite capacity. Because you need to have the whole picture in mind. And, you know, you can either look at it just, you know, there in the levels of total deity function, or even better, you know, let's put it in the, wrap it around the infinite eternal ellipse here. Okay. You know, and we have the level 5 domain at the bottom here, and then we have 6 and 7 wrapping around up to 1 at the top. We're thinking, you know, they said right here, okay, we're talking about the finite level. Okay, we're talking about getting the Supreme into existence in our picture. You know, the Supreme as Mother has to set the stage for this whole finite drama. Okay, you have to get the Supreme in place. Okay, so my attention is focused into the level 6 domain here around the ellipse, where the infinite upholder is there. In there, okay? The unqualified absolute, or the infinite capacity, that's in 7. See, you look on that list, the infinite capacity is in the level 7 domain. Okay. So the upon part, okay, just look at it in simple juxtaposition terms. Level 6, you know, is juxtaposed to 7. So there's an upon, you know, it's whatever's acting going on here is upon that. But remember, this main thing that we're talking about here is this infinite upholder. Okay, and if you go around the infinite eternal ellipse, you know, you start, you know, as you follow the Father around the ellipse, starting up there in the level 1 domain, you know, at the first center, the first source, and you come all the way around, you finally get lastly the infinite upholder. So you have this Father expression wrapping around the ellipse. Well, here you got the infinite upholder. Well, the infinite upholder upholds in the infinite capacity. In other words, the infinite upholder expands into the infinite capacity. That's how the Father gets all the way around, through the infinite capacity. So if you just focus on the Father going around the ellipse, and this is where we're kind of, you know, going a little bit beyond what you have just in the simple list there. But to actually put the Father all the way around, the infinite upholder, see, is actually rooted in level 6 and then expands to fill 7, fills the infinite capacity. Okay? So, see, there's both an in and an upon. Okay? There's the infinite upholder in 6 that's, you know, impinging upon the infinite capacity, but then there's the infinite upholder that's in the infinite capacity. It's literally that sophisticated. See, that those two prepositions can only be understood once you logically think through and get the whole infinite eternal ellipse laid out. Yeah, Jason.
When I read about the Supreme, I hear the word in with God the Mother and on with the Almighty. Is that also as well with this chart too, and each of those qualities?
You were come across it a pot. We've touched upon it some way back in the early Supreme papers. You know, they were doing in and upon. You know, they were using two prepositions, and you guys remember that. Just keep that in mind. Nothing profound to say.
Well, it's either in just, or on is another way to say it.
But just take the prep. Don't gloss over the prepositions. You know, if it has two of them, see if you can figure out why there's two prepositions. How can it be both in and upon? You know, just think about that. It's a little bit like, you know, that God as transcendence is acting upon. But now, you know, but I thought God is immanence is in. It's like, well, yeah, that in that aspect. But you got to, you know, there's many different instances in which you're thinking about both in and upon. And if you're just going to focus on the infinite upholder, there's really two domains. The Father is, you know, lastly here, but then he expands into, you know, God, the Father expands into the infinite capacity. He's the infinite upholder in the infinite capacity. And so really that's where he and she are, you know, you've gone beyond he and she. You're functioning at the infinite level. You're above he and she. You're above Father and Mother. We'll talk about that some next time. Anyway, that's, just wanted to point that out. I mean, that's the kind of complexity that's in the revelation here. I mean, that they're challenging you to put enough of this together that you can try to figure out why there's two prepositions like that. It's quite complex. Okay.
Just another comment on how I kind of understand it. It's very complex, as you mentioned. What I think of the absolute, and again, when I refer to it as kind of like this Pacific Ocean of molecules, okay, I think that the absolute, every molecule in it is related to one another. So you can take a molecule that's in Antarctica and you can relate it to one that's in the Arctic Circle. Somehow everything is completely related and attached. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is why it's so hard to do anything that is absolute by will. It's kind of a tricky thing. You gotta be really good to do something absolute. However, when you talk about in and upon, I think what they're trying to say is that when you act within the absolute, you act upon that relationship between every molecule of water that's in this gigantic ocean so that it relates appropriately to every other molecule. It is all in synchrony and in harmony with every facet that's there.
Right, and
when you act upon it, you take a portion of that and still within the context of acting in relationship to every portion of it, you still take a portion of it out that you're going to work with. That's what he's saying when he takes a cup out, is that he acts upon it. When he acts within it, that cup is still in relationship with virtually everything else.
Right. And that's the basic idea.
That's sort of how I understand.
Right, that's the basic idea. And just, you know, all and what we're doing here, like they're saying, you know, just we're talking about the finite level. So, you're not talking about, you know, you're creating a downstepped expression so that you don't literally have absoluteness, But you do have supremacy. You have ubiquity, not omnipresence. That's why, you go back here. That's why we just went through that section, two sections ago. You know, that whole bit about being everywhere, all connected as if it was one, Antarctica and the Antarctic are one and the same thing, it's not because it's omnipresent, it's because it's ubiquitous. It's because the mother fills that whole space. God as immanence fills that whole space. She is everywhere present from within, and not everywhere present from without. Okay, now, number two here is to finally give some detail to the thing that they didn't explain up there in the big paragraphs that they just summarized in item number one here, the transcendental agencies. What exactly is the deal there and how does that work? Okay, that's what number two is about here.
Eventuation of universe capacities. This involves the transformation of undifferentiated potentials into segregated and defined plans. This is the act of the ultimacy of deity and of the manifold agencies of the transcendental level. Such acts are in perfect anticipation of the future needs of the entire master universe. It is in connection with the segregation of potentials that the architects of the master universe exist as the veritable embodiments of the deity concept of the universes. Their plans appear to be ultimately space-limited in extent by the concept periphery of the master universe. But as plans, they are not otherwise conditioned by time or space.
Okay, again, pretty thick, kind of just like that in the third paragraph up there. Okay, so let's take a moment to work our way through it a little bit. We used a sentence in this paragraph when we were talking about total deity. If you remember that, this is obviously keying into that really big picture. Okay, eventuation of universe capacities, right there in that little subtitle, the infinite capacities, it's a key word. Key in on that facet of deity. Okay, this is going to be primarily about that infinite capacity facet and how I'm going to create downstepped expressions of that infinite capacity. And that's why we brought it up before, as we were talking about the infinite capacity. This involves the transformation of undifferentiated potentials into segregated and defined plans. When we get to the end of the next paragraph, we're going to go back and look this up specifically. But what this is, there's two words there, segregated and defined plans. The actual segregation part of it, when we talked about it before, we talked about projections and plans. Those of you who are here, you might remember we talked about these two different aspects. When we talked about the architects of the master universe. Okay, when we were back up in that third paragraph, we talked about the infinite potential, the label on there, self-purposive deity. We didn't talk about the label on there for the infinite capacity because I wanted to wait until we got to here. What's that label on there? Self-projected deity.
It's the ultimate.
No, that's the infinite capacity.
Oh, okay.
It's on the ultimate level. Okay. But there's two things, two facets of deity on the ultimate level. Besides the ultimate itself, there's also the infinite capacity. Two facets of deity on each one of those levels. Okay, that facet of deity, which is the unqualified absolute from the individuality viewpoint, but you look at it from the unity viewpoint, you call it the infinite capacity, facet of deity, it's self-projected deity. Okay, projected capacity, the two words are tied. You want to look in the book, for Every time, when they already talk about projected, or if they use the word capacity, they're invoking this relationship. They're invoking that facet of deity in some way. Okay. Is the act of the ultimacy of deity? Yeah, I mean, the function of deity on the ultimate level is the ultimacy of deity. That's on the seventh level there. That's what we're talking about. Okay, so how does that work? What they're saying is, you've got these architects of the master universe that are involved in this capacity part. Remember we said that you had a capacity that was getting impregnated with purposiveness because of the action of the Trinity of Supremacy? But we kind of just glossed over. It's like, well, exactly how does the capacity part get established? Well, that's where the architects come in. They're projecting. They're part of this projecting phenomenon. Think of capacity being projected down to the supreme level, so that there's now this downstepped expression of capacity. They're integral to that process of that downstepped projection of capacity. Okay? And technically, how can they do that? Because they're absonite beings. So how do they relate to the finite? Because this is supposedly about the finite level, the seven super universes. The first experiential trinity bridges the gap. What are the three things that are in the first experiential trinity? The supreme creators, the supreme being, and the architects of the master universe. Okay? Now, we're always talking about the first experiential trinity in the bottom-up viewpoint, and so we always think of it, well, okay, first I have the supreme creators that are down here in the finite with me, and then I take it all the way up to the completion, and I get the supreme being, and then, of course, there's those architects that are up there in the absonite. Well, turn it around. Look at that first experiential trinity from the top-down viewpoint. What do you have? You have a means by which the architects of the master universe can penetrate down into the finite. Okay? They can project down. They can project capacity down into the finite. Okay? That's what they're talking about here. And again, how key this, the very fact that you have an experiential trinity and how Trinity is tied to Mother, it's all really very much a Trinity thing we're talking about here. The reason we brought this up, do you remember? We focused on this sentence where we recognized the answer to a question that they weren't allowed to reveal directly. Remember, we went back and looked in the architects section, and they said they could kind of suggest some things. And we found one of these things they suggested. What kind of deity are the architects made out of? These are deity. There's three facets of deity making the super additive deity of the first experiential trinity. There's some kind of deity. What kind of deity are they? They're obviously absonite beings, but we've got different facets of deity. Are they infinite one type deity? Are they universal father type deity? Are they, there's some type of deity. There's some type of downstepped expression of some type of deity. What are they? The key is right here. The architects are the veritable embodiments of the deity concept of the universes. Okay? And this capacity thing. We went through that. We recognized that just like we have infinite upholder type deity that gets downstepped as absonite upholder and finite upholder expressions of that type of deity, you take the infinite capacity type deity and you create an absonite expression, the absonite capacity, that type of deity. That's their bodies. Veritable. Literally, truly. That's their body. That's their deity, the type of deity that they are. They are the absonite capacity type deity. Okay? That's why they do this capacity thing. Because they are what they do. That's the way it always works. In order to do something, you have to be that something. Okay? We've been talking about this. In order for them to do the capacity thing, they have to literally be the capacity thing. They have to literally be made out of capacity-type deity. Their type of deity is the absonite capacity. That's the type of deity they're made out of. Okay, and that's really getting out there. Okay? Because the Father, the Father is, he may be the first center and the first source and the universal Father and the universal creator and the universal controller and the infinite polar, but he's not the infinite capacity, and neither is the Mother. Okay, that infinite capacity type deity is a very odd type of deity. It's so odd that when you look at it from the individuality viewpoint, it's a non-deity absolute. Okay, remember we talked about that? Remember how they mentioned that, it's about the most complicated thing even for the revelators to wrap their minds around. You've got the I am, and then you've got the universal absolute. The unqualified absolute. Excuse me, the unqualified absolute. It's really hard to wrap your mind around something that when you look at it from the deity viewpoint, it's a facet of deity, and you can have it as the type of deity that architects are made out of, for instance. But when you look at that facet from the individuality viewpoint, it's a reservoir of matter. It's a non-deity. Talk about totally going to the other side, diametrically of everything. When you flip it around, it's a very complicated thing to understand, even for the revelators. But anyway, that's what that's about. Okay, yeah.
I don't know if anybody else is having the same conundrum I am. But when you say capacity, I keep thinking of a container.
Yes. Right.
Oh.
Literally. Okay.
So how are they projecting? Maybe you understand. How are they projecting from this level into the finite capacity?
Right.
It was like that capacity would wipe out everything unless that's the capacity that the finite exists within.
Right. There's an infinite capacity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And see. And
so in other words, they create a stage. They create a space from which
there's downstepped expressions of the infinite capacity. Mm-hmm. You have the infinite place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He freed himself from the fetters. Okay, and lastly, he injects himself into that as the infinite upholder. See, but only on the infinite level. He's only the upholder of it in an infinite sense. Not in any sub-infinite way. That's Mother. And, of course, technically, really, at the infinite level, like I said, Father and Mother really break down those terms. The whole point is that when you think of capacity, your initial thought is like we've been leading up to, space, time. Okay, and you think of it in this very nothing sort of way. Extension space is just this empty container.
A room in which to do, to act.
But the infinite capacity is a facet of deity.
Yeah.
Okay? From the unity viewpoint, it is very literal. It's just as literal as the universal Father. Mm-hmm. Another facet of deity. Mm-hmm. Or the infinite one, another facet of deity. Or the infinite. Or, the universal one of infinity. Or any of the other facets of deity. That capacity is literally a facet of deity. And so, because it's a facet of deity, it can have downstepped expressions of that deity at sub-infinite levels. Now, from an individuality viewpoint, you're not going to go, deity, when you touch the capacity. You're going to go, container.
Yeah.
Okay? From the individuality viewpoint, you're going to get container. You're going to get womb. Okay? Now, you get womb. Think about it.
But it's not a mother's womb.
You get the womb because of what the capacity is impregnated with. That's what you say is womb. But you got to say, a womb has a boundary. The creative mother spirit is here, not there.
And the mother spirit also.
Where did the capacity come from? Where did her boundary come from?
Or her body.
Boundary of her body.
Yeah.
Not her body. Her body is, the finite upholder, if you will.
Okay.
but the boundary of her body. How did her body get bounded? Okay, you know, remember, we can't just have the infinite boundary. We need to have sub-infinite boundaries. That's what's going on here. Okay. Yep.
When you're talking about capacity and all this stuff, it sounds like you're talking about a battery or something.
Yeah. When you stop thinking of it as just a container, the volume of the container.
Where things come together, they're reacting kind of stuff.
Right. I mean, see, up here, see, go back and look at it again. The purely static potentials inherent in the unqualified absolute are reactive. Okay. To really think of them as reactive, you need to have it be a something, more literally. If you think of it in the unity viewpoint as the infinite capacity, a facet of deity, that facet of deity is reactive. Okay, it's not just a vacuum, an empty container, okay? Because that's not reactive. Nothing is reactive. It has to be a something to be reactive. What kind of a something is it? It's this something that's called, at the infinite level, the infinite capacity. It's a facet of deity, a type of deity that's reactive. And it's a way of creating an embodiment. All right, so the other thing there, the last little thing, their plans appear to be ultimately space-limited in extent by the concept periphery of the Master Universe. I don't know, the architects of the Master Universe. Okay, that makes complete sense. What exactly is the rest of the sentence trying to tell me? Why did they italicize as plans? It says, but as plans, they are not otherwise conditioned by time or space, and you're going, that's where you've got to have the two words.
Because
there's plans and project, you know, the plan and the projection, okay? Merely as plans, this absonite capacity, these beings, as plans, they're not otherwise conditioned by time or space. It's just the Master Universe, and that's it. The plans fill the Master Universe. There's no other constraints, you know. Right up to the boundaries of eternity and all the way to the limits of the Master Universe, and that's the only, you know, constraints on it. But as projections, they are otherwise conditioned by time or space. For instance, when they're projecting down to the supreme level as the finite upholder, that's, you know, below the absonite upholder, it's further limited by time and space. Or if they project all the way down to a local universe, you know, so that you can have a creative mother spirit, now it's really becoming conditioned, you know, otherwise conditioned by time and space. It's getting, it's that projection for, you know, infinity is being projected down to this very localized region of a local universe. Okay? Quite conditioned. That's what that's alluding to. And you don't know that until you read the next paragraph and you kind of follow it up. I'll show you what we mean. We're gonna see where it tells you right point blank in the book about this, in a place you might not expect. But we did touch on it back when we did Total Deity. Okay, yeah, Jason. That's a thought, yeah. I mean, that the parallel between those two, between the plan and the projection. Yeah, okay, yeah. You're picking up on a parallel there. Yeah, think of that. It's definitely going to into a more active state. And it's going to the projection. It's not just the plans up here in absonite space. You know, it's actually being projected down. Okay, so then the number three here.
creation and evolution of universe actuals. It is upon a cosmos impregnated by the capacity-producing presence of the ultimacy of deity that the supreme creators operate to effect the time transmutations of matured potentials into experiential actuals. Within the master universe, all actualization of potential reality is limited by ultimate capacity for development and is time-space conditioned in the final stages of emergence. The creator sons going out from paradise are, in actuality, transformative creators in the cosmic sense. But this in no manner invalidates man's concept of them as creators. From the finite viewpoint, they certainly can and do create.
Okay. So, just to get that, you know, see, what they're saying is, if you really look at it from the top-down viewpoint, it's very different than when you look at the creator sons from the bottom-up viewpoint. From the bottom-up viewpoint, you call them creator sons. It's like they're creating, you know. He speaks and it is. But we know that the finite just doesn't come out of nowhere. What is the finite, really? The finite is a downstepped expression of the absonite. And the absonite is a downstepped expression of the ultimate, and the absolute. And the absolute is a downstepped expression of the infinite. Okay, it's coming down. So, see, what they're saying here is you really have this, the master universe. See, within the master universe, all actualization of potential reality, okay, but, you know, there's, in this top-down viewpoint, we have this whole thing just being projected down. So why do I even need supreme creators? Can't it all just come down from above? Why do you have to have these guys down there? Okay, because it isn't automatic. When it's projected down, it isn't automatically done. There's another role that needs to be played by the Supreme Creator, transformative. They take what comes down and transform it into what matches the specifics down here. Okay? Now, go back to the beginning of part two. Back to paper 32. Which is an old single column, page 357. Right there in the preface of paper 32. They say just what we just read.
Okay.
I'll read it. In the preface there, you see there's four paragraphs. The last two paragraphs are talking about what we just read in that very complex way. It says the same thing. And it starts out with something I recognize, Urantia. Urantia belongs to a local universe whose sovereign is the God-man of Nabadon, Jesus of Nazareth, and Michael of Salvington. And all of Michael's plans for this local universe were fully approved by the Paradise Trinity before he ever embarked upon the supreme adventure of space. The sons of God may choose the realms of their creator activities, but these material creations were originally projected and planned by the paradise architects of the master universe. Okay, there's two things. Okay, it isn't just creator son goes out and shazams it. Okay? He's got two antecedents before he can do what he does as a transformative creator. You need the architects, and you need something that's related to the paradise trinity. And it can't be just the Paradise Trinity in and of itself, because it's an it. It doesn't fully approve. A who fully approves. Okay? There needs to be the mother, the finite upholder. Okay? established, and then into that domain is projected, okay, from the by the architects. Okay, and now you've got the art, you know, so you have to have the absentite capacity type deity, and you have to have the mother type deity do their thing first. And we just read of all the complicated details of that. That's what we were just reading up there. First, and then in comes the Creator Son into the presence of the Mother, and takes what's been projected down and transforms it in her presence. The combination of what was projected down from the Absinite and in relationship to what's already there as a ubiquitous presence, the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the two, as he, in his very unique way, in his little domain, as he engages it, produces something that isn't either what was there ubiquitously or projected down. It's a superadditive consequence of the relationship between the two via his catalytic action, via his transformative creative action. That's technically how it comes into existence. And of course, you know, he can have he can do this in a localized way. He can do his transformative creator action and have it be contained in a local universe and not spread out over all of the seven super universes, because, you know, there's one other little detail there. You know, that womb of the total finite gets downstepped into a localized womb. Okay. And that constraint confines his creator action. So that when he does his Shazam, it, you know, it stays within those boundaries.
It's contained.
It's contained.
Right.
Okay.
The thing that's confusing me is that they're using the word plans in mm-hmm. both places
yep.
for both things. So to use Jason's analogy, the master architects are saying, let's build a building. And then Michael comes in and says, well, we're going to put a room here and a toilet there and a window there. Details mm-hmm. of plan mm-hmm. A versus plan B.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plan B is very, very detailed. And this is exactly where this molecule is going to go versus
yeah, and you notice, you know, they said, and all of Michael's plans. Okay. So you have a combination of the architect's plans and his plans.
Right.
And there's a sort of a super additive consequence of the relationship between those two plans. And it's just, remember how this projected part, see, you know, here they're using very separate words, projected and planned.
No, see, they use plan to both ones. Michael's plans?
You know, yeah, and there. Architect. Yeah, plans. But I'm going back here now. Back to
plan and plan there.
But they had
their plans appear. But as plans.
Right. I'm just notice the one thing. Segregated and defined plans. Okay? The way they said it there, that segregated part is tied, see, to that projection. They project it down into a segregated capacity.
Okay.
See?
Would it be accurate to say what's projected down as the potentials?
Only when you look at it from an individuality viewpoint. I mean, you know, it's a deity actual from a unity viewpoint. The infinite capacity, you know, is an actual. The absolute capacity is an actual. And it's not like the, you know, the bodies of the architects are potentials. They're actuals. They actually have bodies. See, so what the challenge is, is to put the two thoughts together. Try to play the thoughts back and forth. You know, the title of this paper was Supreme and Ultimate Time and Space. They purposely were trying to stick those two things together. You know the Supreme and Ultimate are deity, and you think of time and space as being something very different, especially space is just like an emptiness of a container. They're trying to, like I told you right up front, the point of this paper is to try to really get you to start thinking about this stuff together. Can you start to think about space and deity together in one thought? You know, and the beginning of it is very difficult. Even the revelators admit it's very difficult. But you can start, at least you have names, and you can constrain your thinking by the names. I know that the unqualified absolute, you know, which, you know, when you think about space, you think about space as having this presence of the unqualified absolute in it. That then gets, you know, through the primary force organizers, gets, you know, turned into the force charge of space. You know, but the unqualified absolute is pretty much like the space. Remember when they talk about that, how the two are sort of just kind of right there with each other, that same very ethereal level of everything. You know, there's space and there's the unqualified absolute, and neither, we can't really touch either of them. But then finally, the force, primary force arguers make something that we can touch. You know, universal force, okay, primordial force. That's what they're going to get at. They're pointing out that it's all very ethereal from the individuality viewpoint. But from the unity viewpoint, it's literally a facet of deity that's kind of rooted in these things. It's called the infinite capacity. It's so literal that you can make the bodies of beings out of it. They're called the architects of the master universe. Okay? You know, and on the you know, what kind, you know, you could think of, you know, just for fun, take it one notch up. If I have the absonite capacity type deity, notch up is the absolute capacity type deity. Well, guess whose body is in part made out of that type of deity? The consummator of universe destiny. We don't want to go into that, but just, I mean, the whole point is, if you just, you know, once you recognize that you've got, everything has a source, everything is coming down, you know, and if they tell me at one point in the book that I have an infinite capacity facet of deity, I know I have downstepped expressions. I have on the absolute level, and the absolute level, okay. I mean, I've got to have expressions of that, and I can start to ask questions like, well, okay, so I have absonite capacity type deity and absolute capacity type deity. I wonder who has that type of body. Look, you know, who is the personalization of that type of deity? And it only takes you a few moments of reflection. Like, oh, well, that's obvious. It's those two things that I could never figure out. What kind of deity is the consummator of universe destiny made out of? You know, he didn't seem to fit in anywhere. It's because they're fundamentally related to these things that are quite removed from father and mother. They're that really vague part of the picture that, from the individuality viewpoint, we start calling things like, well, there's just sort of the space, you know, and that's not God in any way, and it, you know. But from a unity viewpoint, it's a something in a very literal way. Okay.
John has a question.
Yeah, well, one little quickie thought before we wrap up.
Capacity in and of itself is impregnated. When you have capacity, it's mm-hmm. like its own sort of separation. You have you have things within that capacity. They're separated. They need to connect via mind.
Yeah,
they need to connect.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I actually
see, if you don't have capacity, everything's together.
Right.
It's already connected.
Right.
When you have capacity, it has to seek connection.
Yeah, and just start thinking about you know what this stuff is. Okay, you know, that's suggested in this last thing, you know, that we read there in item number 3. Capacity producing presence. See, she, because she has this capacity producing presence, you can inherit that. Through her, you could have capacity to eventually, you know, to be a son of God. I mean, there has to be the God. It doesn't do God the Father any good to try to initiate you if there's no capacity to hold that. See? There has to be capacity for that. And then once he does inject that initiation into that capacity, there has to be something in that capacity that upholds that. See, there has to be these other two facets that are not Father.
Wow.
See? And that's what we're finally getting at. We're finally teasing, you know, all of the aspects of deity apart enough that we're starting to actually understand why we have something called the infinite capacity. What on earth is that? You know, when you read deity and reality, it's, you know, it doesn't ring any bells, you know, what that's talking about. But now you see. You know, if you just think about what you are, this distinction is vital. You're trying to understand what you are, how you work. You know, you're not magical. You have a capacity. Where did that come from? You're being upheld. Where does that come from? You know, you have the ability to wrap your mind around things. Where does that come from? You know, I got initiated. Where does that come from? Et cetera. Just start thinking about all the things that go into making you and figure, follow them up. Somewhere in the book, they tell you what are, you know.
The source point.
The source point. Yeah. Put it all together.
It makes for a rich inner life.
All right.
If you don't go
crazy. Okay. All right, so next time, we'll do something as simple as omnipotence. Yeah. but actually, that was a pretty heavy duty section because that was total deity, like I said. The next two are going to be a lot more approachable, they know. You know, your brain is about to explode, and so you know they're probably going to give you a little respite, something that's going to talk about you really directly. It's like so that you can get your hands on it again. Yeah. So you'll see they do that. So we'll jump into that next time. Let's take a moment.